Fun Ideas Productions presents the Fun Ideas Podcast. Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and welcome to Fun Ideas Podcast number 209. The Fun Ideas Podcast is brought to you in part by Freaky Magazine. I contribute material to every issue, so give it a try.
Hey kids, have you read Freaky? The magazine of weird humor for freaks like you. Freaky Magazine is a way-out collection of weirdo comics, kooky gags, photo funnies, social satire, and surreal collage. 52 pages of insanity in the tradition of magazines of yore like Cracked, Plop, and Zap. Special offer for Fun Ideas listeners, get a free sample copy in the mail, made of smelly newsprint and smudgy ink the old-fashioned way. Just message your mailing address to theslowpoisoner@gmail.com. That's theslowpoisoner@gmail.com while supplies last.
On sale now is Mark Arnold's latest book called Pac-Man, the first animated show based upon a video game. This book tells the story of Pac-Man phenomenon and goes through the entire history of the Hanna-Barbera Animation Studios. The history of the video games, pre-Pac-Man, the history of Pac-Man, the character, the video game, the spin-offs, the merchandise, and the animated TV series. Each and every episode of the classic 1980 series is covered and examined. Plus, Mark Arnold covers how Pac-Man has been honored on various anniversaries, including the 40th anniversary in 2021. A fun read for casual and hardcore Pac-Man and video game fans alike, featuring mini character model sheets and other images. Available online through Bear Manor Media, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble. Get your copy today.
Friends, have you tried Lee's Comics? Lee's Comics is better than the leading comic book store. Wait a minute. Lee's Comics is the leading comic book store. Based on arbitrary standards set by Lee Hester himself.
Lee's Comics was named as one of the 21 best online dealers by PopOptique.com. To shop the Lee's Comics eBay store, go to eBay and search for Lee's Comics, Inc. That's LEESCOMICSINC, period. Don't forget the period. Mention the Fun Ideas Podcast when you order, and you'll receive a free bonus gift. The revised second edition of my Monkeys book with Michael A. Ventrella, called Long Title, the stars of Walt Disney Productions, and the Pac-Man, the first animated TV show based upon a video game, are my latest books out now. I just turned in my manuscript for Unconditionally Mad, and the Turtles book is in production. I'm also working on my TV Cartoons of Time Forgot book, plus articles on Nightmare the Galloping Ghost and Harvey Superheroes. On today's show, we have a documentary filmmaker who is known for such films as Persistence of Vision and Tangent Realms. Here he is, Kevin Schreck.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and it's time for yet another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast. And today I have a documentary filmmaker, and his name is Kevin Schreck, and we're going to talk animation and about the subject of some of his non-animation films. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So probably the simplest question is just tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into making documentary features and shorts and things like that.
So it's kind of interesting because, well, I hope it's interesting. Maybe it's not. But I guess it's relevant in that I think the things that most inspired me as a youth were either animation or documentaries. And they were kind of happening at nearly the same time. I mean, animation a little bit earlier, first film I ever saw was Bambi, and then I saw Fantasia after that. And Fantasia, I've loved both, but Fantasia I really sunk my teeth into. I learned every note, and apparently, according to family members, I would prance around the room conducting like I was Stokowski. I knew like every note, every frame of that movie before, like just when I could barely even walk. And that left a huge impact. And then I saw some nature films by David Attenborough, like The Trials of Life and things like that. And by my preteens, I saw, it was another sort of revisiting of like these two modes of storytelling. I was starting to make movies by about the time I was 10 with like puppets and stuff. And then I would do like little stop motion experiments with like, you know, like action figures or Legos or something laying around. And I discovered The Nightmare Before Christmas, which made me realize I actually like really truly want to make movies. I mean, I, at the end of the This Is Halloween sequence, 4 minutes in, I was almost applauding with the characters, and I was like, I want to know everything about how this was made. The art direction, the character designs, the music, the color theory. I wanted to know everything about it, and that led to a domino effect of sort of film history. Like I would go to the library because I found that movie at the library. We had just gotten a DVD player, and that was one of the only DVDs they had, was The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
Because this was like 2001, maybe 2002.
Okay.
Small little community library in Minneapolis. And I was just blown away by this film and needed to know everything about how they did the stop motion and how they, how the story came to be and what the artistic influences were. And that led to a domino effect because everyone that I learned about, you know, if I wanted to know about what made Tim Burton who he was, for example, I learned about German Expressionism and the Universal Monster movies and Hammer horror films. If I wanted to learn about the things that inspired Henry Selick and the team of animators, I learned about, you know, Willis O'Brien, Ray Harryhausen, Jan Svankmajer. If I wanted to learn about what inspired Danny Elfman, who's probably now my favorite artist in any mode or genre or form, learning about his music led me to learn about Bernard Herrmann, Nina Rota, you know, Korngold, all these other composers and things. It led to this sort of domino effect. So that was a big deal. And then I saw Bowling for Columbine like a couple of weeks later, or a couple of months later. Wow. Very different kind of movie. Yeah. It's a documentary about gun violence. But that had a similar impact on me where I was like, wow, I didn't know that this kind of movie could be that kind of movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's a certain expectation of what documentaries are supposed to be when you're growing up, and that's sort of stuffy and dry and academic. Yeah. And I loved watching documentaries like that when I was a kid because I loved learning about the world. I was a big PBS guy growing up. But when I saw that they could be funny and heartbreaking and infuriating and enlightening all at the same time was a big deal. So, you know, I had this interest in films that either, well, not either, but that both were talking about the world as we know it, or, you know, documentary, nonfiction stories, but also films that had a very specific creative drive and vision behind them, and that they were not necessarily mutually exclusive. With animation, you know, there are no mistakes, there are no accidents, ideally. I mean, you have to make everything from scratch. You know, it's not, an animated movie just doesn't just happen.
Right.
Every single detail is intentional. And with a documentary, you don't maybe have as much control, but if you want to make a real work of art, you do have to have a certain intentionality and vision, almost like you're making a narrative or animated film. So that just kind of, in hindsight, really propelled me. Two very different modes of filmmaking, but what I liked most about both kind of came together. And then I found myself either on occasion making films, documentary films about animation, or documentary films with animation employed in them as a filmmaking technique. So that was kind of an interesting synthesis that was and now 30 plus years in the making, you know?
So was the first movie you made, I'm just going by what I saw on IMDb. So the bastion of accuracy. I always say that about Wikipedia too, but anyway, So if you say I didn't have anything to do with that, well, blame IMDb. Anyway, it says that there was a short about Carl Sagan, or with Carl Sagan in mind, called Aberrations of Light. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess it's not.
Would that be considered your first film or first documentary, or am I way off base?
It's funny. I almost didn't count that one until very recently, like the last year or so, because it was such a student film. It was, okay. I was in a class. I went to Bard College, and very small liberal arts school in upstate New York. And I was studying underneath my professor was in that class, Peter Hutton, who was a renowned experimental filmmaker. Usually did black and white, you know, landscape pieces on 16 millimeter, usually silent, a very different sort of mode from some of the other things that I've described recently. But he was a really good teacher because he was so keen on us getting acquainted with actual 16 millimeter film shot on a real Bolex and dealing with the limitations of that, you know, we were supposed to go out into the real world and film on this old technology. And honestly, going back in time with those parameters and limitations of the technology was very formative, because it really made you make intelligent decisions about how you're making the movie. With digital, you know, you can keep rolling, you know, with if it's in color, you know, you can always change the color with color grade, you know, sound, that's a big part of it. These were films that did not have any sync sound. They were not in color. If you expose it incorrectly, you would destroy everything before your movie was even finished, which was terrifying. And you had about 2 minutes, 45 seconds on each reel, if I remember correctly. So you really had to be precious about what you were filming. And I was so obsessed with exposure and light. And I was simultaneously reading a lot of science books, like just in my free time, like by Carl Sagan and other authors, that stuff was just on my brain. So I made a short experimental documentary on 16 millimeter that used the audiobook from Sagan's Pale Blue Dot to narrate this piece about life across the universe and this sort of thing. And it was early springtime at the time, and life was sort of emerging. You started to see the cycles come back of life and death, and you know, emerging out of hibernation and returning from migration. The greenery was returning, and you almost felt like you were going revisiting this world that, of course, was familiar. But when you look at it through a new lens, literally a new lens, it almost seems alien. And I tried to portray a very familiar forest in upstate New York in mid-March, as though it was from the POV of an alien explorer or something, even though it's written by an Earthling about other planetary systems, possible biospheres or life forms and things like that. So I didn't really consider that as part of my filmography until because it was such a student film.
Au revoir.
But exactly. But when I teach nowadays, I teach filmmaking to students even younger than college age, and I found that it's actually a very good, I guess, that piece, showing that piece along with films by much more accomplished filmmakers from all around the world in different time periods and movements and things. It's useful to show that piece because it's kind of a good, like, humble icebreaker and being like, hey, you know, we all start somewhere, you know, and actually I made this kind of competent thing with very limited technology and very limited skill sets at the time. I'm sure that you, my students, which have these amazing supercomputers in your pockets, these smartphones that, you know, can shoot in 4K and like sync sound and gorgeous color, and you know, the lines between production and post-production are blurred. Like, if I can make something that's semi-coherent with this ancient technology, I'm sure you guys can do things that are even more amazing with what you have in your pocket, you know? So I kind of use that as one of many, many films by many other people also, to kind of just get conversations rolling and get them inspired. And it tends to be one of their favorites, weirdly enough, in the curriculum. So I'm actually, in hindsight, kind of proud of that piece in a weird way.
How long is it?
It's like 5 minutes, a little under 5 minutes.
And four, do you remember what grade you got on it?
I got a good one. I mean, Peter wasn't like a harsh grader. I mean, he it was a liberal arts college, you know, it was kind of pass fail, and I passed, and but he could he was very like honest about people's work too. He wasn't really a guy who would bullshit you. I'm assuming I can say words like bullshit. Oh, yeah. okay, good. He wouldn't bullshit you. He liked it a lot. Yeah, and that was that was also encouraging. It's good to have good teachers, and that's what I try to do when I teach. Yeah. I try to be a good, honest, clear, supportive teacher.
I mean, yeah, and you shouldn't dismiss your college films. When I was in college 100 years ago, they actually had a little film festival. Showed some shorts from Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, Spielberg, a few others, and it was called When They Were Short. And you know, it was cool. Now, in recent times, some of these same films you can actually see streaming for free on some of the channels, you know. It's, it's like I guess they get Scorsese's permission, because those are the ones I really have seen in recent times, to say, hey, can we show these here? Sure, you know. So there's one that's called A Close Shave that he did, where this guy just shaves till he bleeds to death. It's not a very great film, but it's interesting if you don't know much about it. So I'm like, wow, you know. And you can see elements of what was to come from
Scorsese. Exactly.
So, you know, I'm sure
I think that's
the same with you. Yeah.
That's what's exciting about seeing the evolution of a creative process or creative person like that. Like, I do that sometimes with my other film classes. Like, I'll show Ryan Coogler, who is now a mega star filmmaker with, you know, Black Panther and Creed and all these other sort of things. He made this beautiful short film that didn't have any dialogue, set in the Bay Area where he grew up, called Locks. And it's a, you know, from his perspective as a young Black man growing up in that environment, and the importance of hair in that community. And it's really powerful, and there's no dialogue, and it's like less than 10 minutes, but you can totally tell that this is just as much a Ryan Coogler film as Black Panther or Creed is, honestly.
Yeah, it's a style.
Yeah.
But I can see, you know, your point also, and you kind of touch on this, that I think you've actually kind of accomplished this in some of the films we're going to talk about, that, you know, a documentary can be kind of straightforward and serious, or it can have some fun with it, even if the subject's still serious.
Sure.
I think using Michael Moore as an example, I mean, that's, I've been a fan of his. I don't always like everything he is, you know, political views always, but I ignore all that for the sake of that, you know, sometimes he gets the message across that he's trying to get in a humorous way. And I get what he's trying to do, you know, even if I don't always agree with the message. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'm right on. Sometimes I mean, what the fuck is he talking about? But, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter, because he has a style that's appealing, you know, that you want to watch, you know. So
he's a great populist filmmaker, and he's a filmmaker first before he's anything else, I think. And I think he's a genuine article when it comes to that. He's a very good cinematic storyteller, and he knows how to get people's emotions. And that's what we're doing as filmmakers, whether it's animation or documentary or something else, experimental narrative, is you are, you know, creating emotional sensations and provoking audiences intellectually, hopefully, and getting a reaction out of them, an honest, visceral reaction out of them. And I don't necessarily like art that's too safe, you know, that's like wallpaper, you know.
Yeah. Now, the next film, I think, you know, again, correct me if I'm wrong, is this your first feature film? And I have not seen this. The first film I've seen of yours is Persistence of Vision, so we'll just jump there for a second, but you know, we'll talk about that in a minute. But I have to look at it again. The World According to David Liebhan, is that his name?
Liebhart.
Liebhart. Oh, I'm floppy writing on me.
No, it's okay. Now, he actually has a much longer official name, but he usually goes by David Liebhart.
Okay. And I knew nothing of this film, but I'm kind of looking at it. So this is the guy that he's on Tim and Eric's awesome show.
He's one of many. Sort of
because that guy has a story. He seems kind of creepy and weird, but then you know it's like I could say if he's interesting enough, I could see why you'd do a film about him. So how did that one come about? And is that your first feature length then?
Well, it's like 50 something minutes, so I guess it's a mid length technically. It was one of the longer things I'd made some things that were about that long or longer in high school just for like fun or as homework assignments to like instead of doing a PowerPoint or an essay, I went with an even more challenging thing and made a movie instead. But it was more rewarding and more fun, and I think the teachers were more excited to watch them. It wasn't the longest thing that I had made just yet, but that was sort of a cinema verite style documentary following around David Liebehart, who is an outsider artist, I guess you would say, in Los Angeles. He's been doing his thing in LA for, now maybe like 40 something years. At the time it was 30 something, but I made this thing when I was on an internship at DreamWorks Animation in Glendale, California. And I knew Dave was out there and I just asked if he'd be interested, and he was definitely interested in being a part of even an extracurricular, I guess, student film independent thing. I guess it was like the first film that I was making that wasn't for school, but was also with some school training.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a perfect thing by any means, to put it lightly, but it was really good training ground for future stuff. Because I had a kind of one-man band the whole thing. Like, you know, I learned, you know, a lot about what to do and what not to do with that film in terms of technical things with sound or camera or pacing or whatever. But I also learned what worked. And having a subject that was as open as David was great, because he's a guy who's like the quintessential, I'm going to make it in Hollywood someday kind of guy. And in a weird way, he kind of has more than a lot of other people.
Yeah.
But he still is very much under the radar. He's still known as like the guy who hangs around outside of the Hollywood Bowl or La Brea Tar Pits or the Santa Monica Pier and does caricatures that kind of always look the same, or has the weird ratty puppets that have never been washed or... You know, bellows in the sort of like church voice thing. So he's not
even the show he was on, Tim and Eric. I mean, not everybody knows who they are. You know,
that's pretty niche and underground. And I was fascinated by that. But I'm always someone who's interested in the way that things work, whether it's like something biological or zoological, or how art is made, or filmmaking behind the scenes stuff. So I just did a little bit of. I wanted to know who this unusual guy with the puppets and the singing voice was all about, and he was extremely interesting to me, and it was a good training ground making that mid-length documentary, because again I learned a lot of what to do, what not to do, and I think that helped me figure out how to make bigger, more serious, more ambitious projects later on. So I was a very formative year, summer of 2009, because in the daytime, on the weekdays, I'd be working at DreamWorks Animation, which was really an informative process. And then on the evenings or weekends, after dark, you know, it's like it's Bruce Wayne, Batman thing, a completely different lifestyle that I had, where I was making this very underground, zero budget thing, kind of just for the fun of it, about this fascinating outsider artist with an interesting story on the margins of the Hollywood scene, and just seeing that compare and contrast of, you know, the infrastructure and resources of DreamWorks, and then, you know, which is filled with artists, and then you see the artists who are just scraping by if they're lucky, you know, in Hollywood underneath all the glitz and glamour, what it's really like to be an indie artist out there. And that was a very formative process. So
now, how can, you know, these early films like this, is there a place to see them? Are they on home video, or how do you, like, now that I'm aware of it, I didn't research that. So, I mean, are they easily to come by, or are they just kind of good luck finding a film festival?
The Aberrations of Light, which is the short 16 millimeter Carl Sagan inspired one, that is on Vimeo for free. The World According to David Lee Behart. You can rent or buy it for a few bucks on Vimeo.
Okay.
It's nothing special in terms
I'm just
of
kind
like,
of curious about it just because.
Yeah,
hey,
I don't know.
Guy.
I mean, yeah, I mean, he has a following of sorts, and I'm a member of that fan base, I guess. And yeah, we still talk every once in a while. I mean, usually every birthday, Christmas, we'll talk on the phone, and not a whole lot has changed. But it's just nice to say hi to kind of a, you know, a friend. You know,
part
he's an
two.
Interesting guy.
No, part
maybe
two.
Who knows?
Okay. Update. Anyway,
yeah, sequel.
You mentioned DreamWorks. So, what were you doing at DreamWorks at the time then?
I was officially an intern in the post-production department, but 2009 was an interesting year because it was the only year that I can remember for quite some time that they only had one feature come out.
Mm-hmm.
And their one feature of 2009, which I think was called Monsters vs. Aliens, I think that had already come out that March.
Hmm.
And I was there from like June through August. So I didn't really have a whole lot to do in post, which was great because that meant that I could go to other departments and see what they might want from one of us lowly interns. I say that with some, I'm being a little facetious. It's an incredibly supportive environment, honestly. And I'm still friends with several people that I met there, both who were fellow interns and who were, you know, full-time employees there. And even people who've moved on outside of that world, I'm still in touch with them. So I was in post officially, and I would always start my day doing what post needed. And there was work to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I could go to editorial, or I could go to the art department, or I could go to, you know, whatever films were on pre-production, or even like marketing and, you know, competitive tracking and these sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
Things that people aren't even, who even know a lot about animation, aren't totally aware of as part of these big industry studio things. And kind of explore a lot of different projects. I don't really have any. One of the good things about being an intern at DreamWorks is you get paid.
That's
one of the downsides to it is you don't get screen credit for anything. So I worked on like 5 or 6 DreamWorks animated movies,
uh-huh.
but I don't have any screen credit on any of them because, you know, that's just not a union or I don't know. There's something in the contract that doesn't really give you that thing. But I did like some scratch track for fun on Kung Fu Panda 2.
Uh-huh.
Like for dialogue sessions, for the animatics, I did some, what else did I do? Some like art department things for, How to Train Your Dragon, or some like editorial things from How to Train Your Dragon, just like helping them QC stuff, like easy, easy things. But, you know, you appreciate the fact that, no part of the machine is unimportant. Everything has to be working. And that really gave me, I think, a lasting impression of, you know, even the interns or the production assistants or the assistant editors, they matter. They are important to the way things work because somebody has to double check the footage. Somebody has to make sure that the crew is hydrated and fed. Somebody has to make sure that, you know, they're double checking all the electrical equipment or whatever it might be, you know, getting another pair of eyes on a cut or making decisions on art direction or something. It's just, you know, there's a sense that people have like of a hierarchy, but
mm-hmm.
everybody, even if that hierarchy does exist,
mm-hmm.
everybody in that tree on that ladder matters, you know, and that's at least the attitude that I try to have on my productions. They usually are pretty low budget and ragtag, and I have to wear a lot of hats. But even when I do have the resources and need for, say, a production assistant or an intern or something, not only will they be paid, but, you know, their input and perspective matters. And that was, I think, useful to me because I was one of those.
Yeah.
And I mattered. Maybe smaller than other people, but it was still an important part of the system.
Yeah. It's interesting that you didn't get screen credit because you watched like certain Disney and Pixar films and they're mentioning people that had babies during the production and stuff like that. Seems like they mentioned
yeah
anybody, you know, Bob walked through the room. Hey, let's put him on the credit roll. You know, it's like
I would be a little miffed if DreamWorks had DreamWorks babies, but thankfully they don't do that. No, a couple of companies do. Disney does. I think Pixar does. And one of the other ones does too. But DreamWorks does not do that, and that's probably better for us interns
because at least we get paid. About... That's good because there's so many.
Situations. Yeah, we got.
Hey, you don't get paid, and they work cool you like pay. A slave. You know, so hey,
yeah, I. That also taught me that, like, I don't really hire interns because that implies that they're unpaid. I, in most contexts, I hire production assistants.
Yeah,
you know,
cause that's cool.
They're going to be compensated.
So, the next film after the David Leave a Heart.
I'll get it. You got right. it.
One of these days, there you go. Cut, edit. No, just kidding. So the next one is the one I know about from is your earliest film, Persistence of Vision. So is that the next one that you did? And if so, how did that come about? Because that's a fascinating story that nobody, at least personally, I mean, knew about. I mean, probably people in the industry knew about it, but you know, just as a person watching cartoons and stuff, I was like,
sure.
How come this film never came out? Thief and the Cobbler is what we're talking about, but you know,
it's right,
like,
of course,
things like that. So.
So, I'll give you the long version one because you're probably used to my long-winded tangents already. If you're listening for this long, and also I think it will entertain you and your audience the most of maybe all the anecdotes I have, or be at least the most relevant to them. So the long story is that, you know, I mentioned earlier that I was trying out stop motion animation as a preteen and teenager. And I would ask animators, professional animators, how do I start? How do I become an animator? And they all said, get Richard Williams's book. And it had only been out for like a year or so, but it was already the go-to tome on how to animate in the opinion of most animators. You know, there's different attitudes in, you know, The Illusion of Life, and there's a Preston Blair book, and these are also important works, but pretty consistently people say you got to choose one book. The Animator's Survival Kit by Richard Williams is the one to go to. So I read that, and clearly the guy knew what he was talking about. I didn't really know the name. I knew Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That was also hugely influential on me as a youngin. But it taught me a lot. I mean, it taught me how to do lip sync and make exposure sheets for the dialogue. It taught me overlapping action and the soft bits versus the hard bits. It taught me about walk cycles and how I could avoid them. So I would make films where characters didn't walk on purpose. It was clear that this Richard Williams guy knew what he was talking about, and Roger Rabbit's amazing. But I was kind of scratching my head reading this book as an adolescent. I was like, how come this guy is so amazing in animation, but I don't know his name from anything except for Roger Rabbit? Shouldn't this guy have like a list of like feature animated films that he's directed over the decades? That's how I thought this is how I thought the world worked when I was 15 or whatever. Years pass, a few years pass. I'm going into college at Bard, and someone tells me in freshman year about this lost animated masterpiece called The Thief and the Cobbler. And that automatically made my ears prick up and my eyes widen. And I was like, oh, I got to know what this is. And so I watched this, you know, the fan edit that's out there by Garrett Gilchrist, the recobbled cut, as it's known. And at the time, it was on Google Video, 360p, terrible, terrible quality. But I was mesmerized. I could see where the genius was coming through of this brilliant artist. And the fact that it was unfinished made me want to know the backstory of it. And then I saw that name again, Richard Williams, and I was like, oh, wait a minute, he spent nearly 30 years working on this thing? That answered the question I had years prior, which was, why isn't he more well-known for this huge oeuvre of animated films? It's because, you know, there were a few projects here and there and a lot of commercial assignments throughout, but it was really all about one big passion project, ultimately, that was never finished in the way that he wanted it to be. And I found that the backstory behind the making of the film was vastly more interesting than the already fascinating and beautiful and heartbreaking film, or rather what remained of it, of the Thief and the Cobbler. So I knew that I spent like 2 years just for fun, like researching this thing about Richard Williams and The Thief and the Cobbler and everyone involved in it. All these animators, like, you know, Art Babbitt, Emery Hawkins, Ken Harris, Tisa David, all these folks who worked on the film and the people who were still with us too. And I kind of had accidentally done 2 years of pre-production on a film that didn't yet exist. But when I was at DreamWorks, I was talking with Steve Hickner. I you know, you had the chance to like talk to these amazing people as equals. And Steve Hickner was one of the directors on Prince of Egypt and B-movie and stuff. And he loved documentaries. Like when I first talked to him, he was raving about this wonderful documentary called Anvil, The Story of Anvil, which is about these two middle-aged Canadian metalheads who still want to make it big. And it's one of my very favorite documentaries. And I recommend Anvil to anyone who just likes a good film, whether you're into metal or not, whether you're into documentaries or not. It is a great film about the human experience. And I was like, oh, this guy's interesting. I want to talk to Steve more. So I was like batting around ideas about, like, you know, the whole evolution versus creationism thing and some other natural history things. And we were trying to find a story. And Steve was like, these are all important subjects and topics, but do you have an idea that actually has a story, like a clear arc and a three act structure? Just hypothetically, it doesn't have to be the one you want to make, but what would be an example of a strong story that you know well, like the back of your hand? And I was like, well, there's the story of Richard Williams and The Thief and the Cobbler. And he already knew that story because he worked with Williams on Roger Rabbit and maybe something else too. And he was like, see, that's a story. It has a clear arc. It has this suspense and this drama, this and that. That's a great story. Let's try to find a story like that for the other ideas you're pitching to me. Because I knew that I had to make a final project for college, and that was coming up. So he was like, let's find a story like that for the natural history stuff you're thinking about. And I was like, woke up the next day and was like, wait a minute, why don't I just make that movie? The one about The Thief and the Cobbler. Like, that already has the story that Steve Hickner is telling me. You got to have story. You got to have character. You got to have plot. And I already knew the whole story. I'd spent 2 years obsessing over it for fun. I basically just had to email people and say, you know, would you ever possibly, hypothetically, maybe consider being part of this thing? And almost everyone said yes. And everyone who didn't say yes, who was actually involved in the production, was usually very British and very polite and was like, oh, I'm sure I have nothing to contribute. But here's so-and-so's email. You should talk to them and maybe they can help you out. Keep me posted. I hope it turns out great. This is a story worth telling. Pretty much everybody, except for Richard Williams, who didn't want to go on record to anybody about it at the time, said yes to the film. So we raised some money on what was then a young website called Kickstarter. My friend Sarah Taylor and I went over to London for 2 weeks in the August of 2010, filmed, I think, close to a dozen interviews with animators and music composers and rendering artists and in-betweeners who worked on the film at various points in its 30-year production history. Came home with a bunch of interviews and also with like 2 hours of footage that no one had seen in a long time. One of the special effects animators in the film, Simon Maddox, said, you know, and again, in a very, you know, down-to-earth British way, like, oh, I don't know if this interests you at all, but I have a few pneumatic tapes from the end of The Thief. It probably has some interesting pencil tests if you're interested. I could get them, you know, converted to a digital format if that's helpful. I was like, yeah, that might be helpful. So he gave us these files, and it was 2 hours of animation, rough pencil animation that nobody had seen in over 20 years, some of it dating back to the early 70s when The Thief and the Cobbler was still Nazarene. And you could see line tests and animation by Art Babbitt, by Tisa David, Emery Hawkins, Ken Harris, and various other animators that worked on the film. And of course, Richard Williams himself. And it was almost like looking at like geological history, like the fossil record, and see these transitional forms from, you know, lobe-finned fish to tetrapods and land animals. And like, you could see the characters' designs change, and scenes that were in twos become scenes in very fluid and expressive ones. And that's when Sarah and I really knew that, okay, we can actually make this into a film. I mean, I was kind of getting away with it a lot because I was like, No one's going to see this. It's a student film. It's a homework assignment, technically, so that I can graduate. But maybe it's now or never. And then I made it, and it kind of snowballed and avalanched into something that gave me a career. Mm-hmm. And that was my documentary, Persistence of Vision, about Richard Williams and The Thief and the Cobbler. And, you know, I think it is in some ways a little bit rough around the edges and a little bit, you know, like you were saying, indicative of like one's early works. But I'm thankful for the impact the movie had with, like, you know, discourse. And, you know, I'm still invited regularly to screen it at major universities and institutions and give Q&As. And people care about the story, and I guess they like the documentary enough to screen that. And I'm very thankful for the opportunities that project has given. And it was close to my heart and kind of defined a lot of the works that interest me, which are biographies on really fascinating, creative, passionate people who also might be complicated or self-destructive or are human just like you and me. Because sometimes you see a documentary about someone who has fans and it's just 90 minutes or 2 hours of gushing over this person. And I didn't want that. Like, I don't want to character assassinate someone that I really like, respect and admire. Of course not. I'm not trying to make a scathing tabloid, but I want to show them as a three-dimensional portrait, a human being.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's flaws and all. And I think that's also been maybe a little bit part of the success of the documentary, was that it wasn't just sort of a nerdy geek out kind of thing. I wanted it to be accessible to other people and not alienate either lay audiences who didn't know much about animation or people who consider themselves to be animation scholars who may have already heard of this story but wanted to see it told in a cinematic fashion. So
yeah,
hopefully I found a good middle, even though it's a very low budget.
I'm kind of more on that end. I mean, but honestly, I didn't even know the story that well. You know, all I knew was it was the movie that never got finished. You know, it was kind of like an Orson Welles thing. You know, it's like, this is the movie that never got finished. And
right
you know, it, people would always say that, and you'd see bits here and there, you know, stuff like that, but nobody ever said, you know, it's like, oh really, at least to me, why, you know. And it's probably because it takes, you know, a good hour and a half to really tell the story, so you know. You know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm glad that it did its job, I guess. I graduated, yep. And people liked the movie, and they still talk to me about it. I still will meet people at like parties or screenings, you know, maybe once or twice a year, not that often. I'm not like a celebrity walking down the streets of New York, but like once in a while, someone will come up to me and say, hey, aren't you that guy who made that documentary on Richard Williams and even the Cobbler? And then they'll be like, oh, I really appreciate that. Or thank you for finally telling that story the right way. Or like, I had no idea that's what was going down and it was really illuminating. Or, oh, I still talk about it with my friends today. We still debate about it. And, you know, who's to blame? What happened? How could things have gone differently? Could they have gone differently for Richard Williams and his passion project? And, you know, I love that films can sometimes have a life even when the projector turns off or the DVD ejects from the player, or, you know, or people, even when people have gone to sleep and woken up the next day, if they're still thinking about it in a positive way, something special happened. So it's nice that that has happened, even for, geez, at this point, 10 and a half years since it was released in film festivals. Yeah.
Yeah. Now that one, it is a lot easier to access. So yeah, that's probably why I saw it. But I think I did see it originally in a theater way back.
Yeah. Where do you think you saw it?
Probably in the San Francisco Bay Area, because that's where I grew up.
Oh, sure.
Like that, yeah. I think it was showing, if memory serves, I think it was at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, you know.
Yeah. I think it showed either the Castro or the Roxy or both.
It might have been the Roxy, but yeah, it was in San Francisco. I know that. Because
okay.
I live in San Jose, but I don't think it made it down to San Jose. I had to go to travel to San Francisco for it.
Yeah, not or that it did well, air
in
you.
San Jose. I just happened to be in San Francisco, so I don't know.
Sure.
But no worries. I'm in Oregon, and they don't have any type of theater like that, and I'm pulling the rest of my hair out.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, well, it's still still on Vimeo and on DVD as a two-disc special edition with the Thief and the Cobbler work print and a bunch of other stuff that you may not want to watch, but deleted scenes and other stuff. So I don't know. I try to Criterion Collection my stuff because that's how I like to have home format stuff with all the goodies.
Is that on Blu-ray nowadays, or is it just on DVD?
It's not. The other film is, if the demand was high enough, but you know, we just don't know where.
Yeah.
You know, streaming and home formats are going these days. I still love having physical media, not even in some precious way, but like, you know, if it gets scrubbed from a streaming service, I still have it at home, and that's kind of what I would want to do for people too. Yeah. But
I'm that way too, but I always think it's because I'm ancient or something, and that's what I grew up with. But it does have something to do with it. It's like, to me, when you stream something, it doesn't feel like you own it, you know? Even if you have it stored somewhere,
right.
It's like, it still feels like I taped it off the radio, to use old language.
Right.
You know?
Seeing the spine in your collection, there's something satisfying about that. Like, seeing your favorite movies together. I don't know, maybe it's a little fetishistic or materialist, but you do technically have it in the same way that you do a collection of books or vinyls, you know?
And that's another thing too, you know, it's like, not that they haven't been doing this a lot, but let's say you stream, and it probably wouldn't happen with your film, but let's say you're streaming, I don't know, Gone with the Wind, let's say that one, because that one can't be considered offensive for some buddy,
sure.
You know, and you know, it's the 4-hour print or something. And then suddenly they decide, we're going to go through and cut like 10 minutes out of it because we find that offensive. And so nobody gets any access to the 4-hour print anymore. It's a 3-hour, 50-minute print. And that's all you get because you don't have it on a home video. It's only on your streaming thing. You're at the mercy of the streaming company. And that's why I tend to like the physical media, because it's like, you can edit it all you want. I got the full version here, you know? So
We have a sense that everything is within grasp, the push of a button, this immediacy to everything, but we're still in the era of lost media for sure.
Yeah. Or, you know, just on any film, you know, the contract ran out. We can't show that anymore. The end. You know,
exactly.
It's like, as simple as that. It's like, but the film only came out 5 years ago. Well, sorry, we don't have the rights
for
five years. You know, oh, well. So which film was next? I mean, it's like looking, is it Tangent Realms or is it something else that was next?
No, that was the one. I spent a good number of years kind of just like, you know, as a very independent filmmaker, I kind of had to be everything on Persistence of Vision, and that's still kind of my, you know, modus operandi. I'm kind of like, you know, you have to be director and at least to a certain extent producer, camera, edit, etc. You might work with other people on those things too, but you still have to do a lot of things. And I was also my own marketing guy and my own publicist, and so I had to really just keep putting out there because the demand kept going. I had to keep sustaining that because people kept wanting to show the documentary for years at film festivals and different institutions and things like universities or museums or whatever. So I kind of just kept doing that, and I wasn't so much drained as I was just like, okay, I'm clearly going to have to do this again if I want to keep being a filmmaker. So I needed, the next project has to be something that's really close to me also. I can't just do it because I'm like kind of interested in it. It has to be a real commitment.
Right.
It's like a relationship or growing something. You know, it's like it's going to be several years of involvement with this passion project.
Right.
So Tangent Realms kind of came about. I don't remember exactly the moment it came about, but I think the moment that it came about was a couple of years into Persistence of Vision's film festival circuit. I was reminded of an article that I saw on, I think, a blog called Tetrapod Zoology, which is run by Darren Naish, a paleontologist. He was writing things about scientific depictions of hypothetical, highly intelligent dinosaurs. And that was like, okay, great. Like, synthesis of two things that I'm fascinated by, like artistic depictions of science things, you know? In a creative way, like science fiction scenarios. And this one guy, this Turkish guy named Memo Kozman, had not only drawn the hypothetical and scientifically accurate intelligent dinosaurs, which were kind of bird-like in their anatomy and form, but even drew what their artwork would look like their cave art. And I was like, that was so spellbinding. And I had actually encountered his artwork before in college. Again, college years are important. I guess that's part of the through line too. And he was actually, even though his work was so nuanced and mature and sophisticated, he was only a few years older than me, like 5 years older. We're close in age. And weirdly, in experiences too, even though I grew up in Minnesota and he grew up in Turkey, like we had very similar interests and sort of life experiences. And so, you know, I remembered that I wanted to get some artwork from him years ago as a high schooler. And I said, hey, how much are these paintings of like this sort of dinosauroid cave art? It's really spellbinding and haunting. I'd love to have one. He was really happy to hear from me. He gave me a very fair price, but I was a kid. I had no money. So I was like, yeah, I can't afford that, but thank you. I got back to him 10 years later, I think, close to 10 years later, and said, hey, do you remember me? I just remembered your artwork, found the old emails, and I would love to finally buy one of these from you. Do you still have them? And Memo said, oh, I'm so flattered. I do remember hearing from you. I don't have those pieces anymore, but I can make new ones for you and do it at a discount. And I said, don't worry about the discount. I waited all these years so I could afford it and pay you what you're worth.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to seeing the new ones. And they were just as elegant and haunting and spellbinding as before. And we kind of built a friendship online that way. So I thought, well, maybe there's a short story here or something, just even a survey of his art or something, almost like a cinematic coffee table book, you know? Fly out to Turkey if I have the time and money to do so. I did when I was working for a company. I found myself on a job in Czech Republic, in Prague. Prague isn't too far from Istanbul, Turkey. So instead of going home to New York, I went to Istanbul, filmed with Memo and his lovely wife, Ushin, and met his other important people in his life and filmed them. Filmed a bunch of his art, filmed a bunch of him making art. And as the days and weeks progressed, I realized there's more than just a 10 to 20 minute long short here. There is a bigger story. And it became Tangent Realms, The Worlds of C.M. Kosman. It's a rarely seen movie because it's incredibly niche and very low budget. But for what it's worth, it's the film that I am currently most proud of and I think is most personal to me. And I say that with like a grain of salt with like the whole proud of, because I really can't stand watching my own work usually, at least historically. Yeah. But I cringe less with Tangent Realms. I feel like it's the thing that is most honest from me, and or I don't know, most authentic. I don't know what it is, but I it's a weird little art for art's sake project. But I'm glad I made it, and Memo and I are still friends and in touch, and I guess inspiring one another or something. But yeah, I thought his story was really gripping and his art was really fascinating and compelling. And I think it's a good attempt at a portrait of an artist in any time or place. But it was especially interesting because he was at a similar point in his life and career that I was. Like, he had some success but had to keep churning it out to continue to have success. And right. Geographically he was at an interesting place in Istanbul, where it's like literally at the crossroads of different worlds, and he in his early 30s was at a crossroads of his development as an artist and as a person. Like, you know, there's no more screwing around, you're a grown-up now, like figure out what you're doing and commit to it.
Yeah.
But also you're young and you have a lot of things you have not yet accomplished, and things you want to say that you don't know how to say yet in your art. And I realized his art actually had a lot more to do with, was more than just the science fiction concepts of aliens and dinosaurs and mythological figures. It was a lot more nuanced and almost therapeutic for him in a way. So yeah, And that's on Vimeo and Blu-ray and DVD also.
Now, did you take that on the same film festival circuit and do the same type of rounds and everything with this film?
It wasn't nearly as successful because
I wasn't asking that. I kind of figured it's a little more niche, but you know, but at least you went around with it, or was that
a few times? I kind of knew it would go nowhere. I didn't put my expectations very high. Mm-hmm. My expectations were low and stayed low, and I kind of, but it was sort of, again, coming back to that Bard college education where the people who were teaching me and the people who were learning from, they weren't on red carpet galas and like premieres and things. I had that for a little while with my, like, literally my name in lights on marquees with Persistence of Vision. That was a very surreal thing to have happen when you're 23 years old. Right. But here I was, you know, in my later 20s, and, you know, it was the sophomore project, I guess. And this was more like the avant-garde experimental filmmaker's career trajectory. It was like something that nobody really has seen, but the few who have seen it liked it a lot, and it spoke to them. And in a way that is almost like a badge of coolness with that, like this sort of hipster thing where it's like, oh no, you've never seen this movie, but if you have, you might like it. If you know, or whatever. I don't really care about that sort of street cred or whatever. I don't think that's kind of bullshit attitude to really have sincerely. But it's kind of funny that like I was in an environment, this liberal arts college, where that's kind of what real art is, and all of a sudden I had this thing that no one had seen or cared to see, but if they did see it, they kind of liked it, and like the right people saw it for the right reasons and liked it for the right reasons. And like you said, it's out there. It's on Vimeo. If anyone wants to check it out, I'll do it again because you've told me to have things near me. I got the Blu-ray here. You can hear me babble on for 102 minutes on the DVD commentary.
Strangely enough, you know, I must have been aware of it. I have not seen it, I'll admit.
Yeah.
But, you know, the cover art, if you want to hold it up again, you know, it'll look very familiar.
It may not.
You know, it's like, and hold it in front of your face. There we go.
Oh, it's really hard to see.
There we go. Yeah.
Well, and, yeah, his, you know, art is...
How it looks there. Yeah, that's enough. But how it looks there.
It's hard to see.
You know, I go, I must have been aware of this because, you know, that looks very familiar to me, you know, but I know I haven't seen the documentary, but I like watching little documentaries of all sorts of things. I mean, I do that all the time. I'm flipping around streaming channels, especially on free ones, because, you know, they put documentaries on there. It's like, I, you know, like you said earlier, it doesn't have to be about a subject I care about. It just has to be done well.
No.
So that's the main
thing. I actually like underdog stories more because, I mean, let's be honest, like there are some very good documentaries out there about familiar subjects, but we have plenty of documentaries about the Beatles. We have plenty of documentaries about Bob Dylan. We have plenty of documentaries about Michael Jordan. And not that these folks are not deserving of documentaries, but I don't know if I'm the person to tell those stories either. Like, I don't know what it's like to be part of a like culture changing band or be one of the greatest athletes of all time. But I think I know how to make a documentary about, you know, a young, complicated, ambitious artist who's kind of funny and unique and charismatic and has deep things they want to explore. Like, I can relate to that in some degree, and nobody has made a film about, at least to this caliber, about Richard Williams or Memo Kosman or the other subjects that I have done portraits of. So it's kind of fun to explore that new, fresh territory as well.
I think I take the same approach when I do my books. I mean, I have done books on the Beatles, you know, but when I did the Beatles book, it was my own opinions about things. But in general, I try to, like all my animation books, I try to avoid doing yet another Disney book. However, I've done two. When I do them, I try to take a different angle that nobody's ever covered before. If I'm doing an animation book, I'll take a studio that's never been covered before, and that at least I'm passionate about. You know, and it sounds like you're passionate about Kosman, you know, in this film. Mm-hmm. So that helps. I mean, you're not just doing work for hire, like, oh, I have to do a film about this Turkish guy. Okay. You know,
right.
It kind of comes out half-assed because you just kind of like weren't that interested, but you had to do it to fulfill a contract.
Right. Or something.
So,
yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and doing work for hire is good to train yourself and pay the bills and stuff. But yeah, it's, I like it when it comes from the heart, you know? So, yeah.
So, I mean, if somebody paid you and said, yeah, we need you to do yet another Beatles documentary, well, you'd probably be able to do one because, you know, or maybe do it in a different twist than what's been done. So it kind of comes off.
If someone offered me to direct a Marvel movie, I'd do that in a heartbeat because I would have healthcare for life and, you know, maybe a mill or a couple million laying around or something.
You mean you're not like Scorsese or Spielberg and they poo-poo the idea? Oh, I can't do it.
I would love to make, I would never get Final Cut, but it would be really fun to make a subversive Marvel movie that Marvel people may not like.
Howard the Duck, like my favorite remake.
Do a better one. Oh, I would love to do a. I would love to remake Howard the Duck. That'll be my pitch. If
man Marvel thing in there,
my door.
You know, all the,
there
all,
we go.
All the characters that were actually in the comic book, Kidney Lady, and all that.
I would
stuff,
love
anyway.
To do. Yeah. He would still have to be a puppet, though. I would not do a CG Howard the Duck. He'd still be a puppet.
Oh, that's
puppet.
Fine. Yeah. But don't make him cutesy poo. Make him more surly and nasty.
Oh
like
no! Like he'll be chomping a cigar and he'll be like a gross womanizer, but it'll be a post Me Too version as well. So it'll be like he's not really the hero. He's sort of this scuzz bag.
All right, I'll be first in line because that's what I want. That's what's always bugged me about the original Howard.
And there will be obligatory cameos. Paul Rudd will show up, I'm sure. Yeah. You know, I think he'd be down with something silly like that. He's a good guy.
And you could get what's his name again? I should Dave Lee. Dave Lee, and you can even
Dave
have Sam Coastman come in. Get all your old,
all my characters,
from your old documentaries making Spike, cameos. Instead of the Spider Verse, it'll be your own verse. You know, it's like,
it'll be a Kevin Shrek joint. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so at this point, I see other films, but I don't know if they're in release or not. So I'm just going to ask about it because I think they're in various stages of completion or you're working on them from what I can tell.
Yeah. We're now in act three. We're now in act three of the interview.
Okay. And it doesn't look like you do one project, promote it, do another project. You're working on multiple things at the same time.
And is I don't know which is better or worse, honestly, because I don't intend to. Oh. Have too many things going on at once, but sometimes life just happens that way. Yeah. But sometimes it actually is good to have multiple things running at once because you don't know when one will come out. I mean, like, for example, like, I was very, like, with Persistence of Vision and Tangent Realms, I was very specific about one project at a time. Like, it's too much to do. I got to pay the bills with other work as well. These are just my hobby things that maybe I'll make some money from 3 or 4 years down the road. But I can't rely on that. I have a life to live, a bank account to tend to. I have to keep my sanity, this and that, relationships, you know, all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But now I'm not, maybe it's multiple factors, but there's like several, at least multiple things happening. One of them is you were alluding to is called Inongo. And that is another feature-length documentary about an artist, not too unusual for my filmography, but it's a different kind of project in a lot of ways because it's not a visual artist. It's a woman who is a musician. She's a rapper, producer, also a PhD candidate. She's a fascinating polymath. Mm-hmm. She's also a Black woman, a first-generation American. Her parents are from the Ivory Coast and the Congo. And they're immigrants, and they expected their daughter to be, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, and here she wanted to be a rapper. but still was, and still is, firmly in academia, too. And also she's, you know, someone who deals with mental health concerns that I don't personally share. And so there's a lot of similarities, and it's another film about artists. It's about someone who's about my same age. You know, a young American growing up in the 21st century, early 21st century, trying to be an artist and trying to make a living that way. That's familiar territory to me. But a black woman who is a first generation American who deals with depression, anxiety, and imposter syndrome clinically, you know, that was new territory for me. And I realized that I was kind of early on making a decent enough, but not stellar documentary about, you know, a musician, which there are plenty of behind the scenes, cinema verite documentaries where it's, you know, D.A. Pennebaker or whomever is making this sort of fly on the wall thing with a few scattered interviews, maybe. And I like that format a lot, but it didn't feel totally unique yet. So eventually animation became part of the equation. Lo and behold, and now I'm a director of animation on this thing, as well as the other stuff that's involved with making an indie documentary. But it's actually made the film a lot better, not as a gimmick, because I love animation, as we've discussed here. Hugely inspired by animation. I've studied animation all my life. But I really don't usually like when animation is used in documentaries, because it's usually used kind of as a crutch. Yeah. It can be a useful tool, but sometimes it's just a gimmick.
Yeah.
But I really wanted the animation to be instrumental to the storytelling, that the film would be radically different without the animation. And that means that there's going to be a lot of animation. And by a lot, I mean about 10 to 12% of the movie will be animated, which doesn't seem like a lot, but 10 or 12% of anything is a notable fraction. And it's also made the movie 2 or 3 times more expensive than I expected it to be just because of that 10% and just because it's animated. But it is a stronger movie. It's still in production because, you know, we're moving at a snail's pace with one coming out of the throes of a global pandemic.
Right.
That's not easy to make a documentary about a traveling musician when there's, you know, a respiratory virus going around.
Right.
And animation is a slow process. And she's working in academia, too. So at Brown. It's hard to find time to film this stuff, but I also know that I'm in no rush. This movie will come out when it's ready to come out, when it's a good finished movie. And I have an amazing team of people involved. Like, I'm just some, and I told Inongo this early on, like, I'm just some, you know, dorky white guy from Minnesota. We have a lot in common, but there's some obvious notable differences here. But I told her very early on, I knew two things about the film. One is that I want it to be, to have the same, the title should be her name, which is her first name, Inongo. Because it's a beautiful name that nobody else seems to have in this part of the world, and nobody has heard, even though it's a very easy name to pronounce, and a very easy, it's very phonetic. It's a very unique name here, culturally, geographically, and it's a beautiful name. And I also told her that I wanted the team to be, you know, have experiences that were more like hers, to be a genuinely diverse team. And I didn't want that to be like some sort of liberal, like, pat yourself on the back, sort of like, you know, corporate accomplishment thing. I really knew that collaboration was essential because I needed a really good composer to make a score. I'm not a composer. I needed many camera operators to film different angles of her on stage in concert as her stage persona, Samus, which is inspired by the video game character from Metroid. I knew that if there was going to be animation, we're going to need real animators. So pretty much everyone else is, you know, either black or a woman, usually a black woman, and young. And more importantly than the demographic stuff, even though I think that's important too, because, you know, you're right about what you know. Most importantly, these are skillful young artists who have the tenacity and the talent to tell this story. And it's a story that personally connects with them. You know, like, I'm paying everyone on the team, but, like, I'm not paying them millions of dollars. Like, I'm paying them enough that we can all get by to make a movie. And it's very low budget, all coming out of my pocket at this point. Until we do some more fundraising, which is not a healthy thing to do, but that's what you have to do as a producer sometimes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, they're working their butts off making something that they really care about. Like, pretty much everyone on the team has been very candid with me and has really expressed their gratitude to be involved in this project, because it's a story that they connect with, seeing someone that looks like them, that has similar experiences to them personally. And you know, I was initially making a film about an artist like I normally do, but it's become something much bigger in terms of scale, in terms of budget, in terms of ambition. And you know, it might be a little bit like Linklater's Boyhood. It might be a decade in the making, I don't know. But I have that in the works. We might have some more fundraising for Inongo soon, but in the meantime, I have the other thing, which is my background, which is my wallpaper background, which is which seems like a completely different world.
Yes,
but I've been hired to, with a grant from the National Science Foundation, to make a documentary around the sub-Antarctic, on the vessel that's behind me called the Gould. Uh-huh. And it's a scientific research vessel, and I'll be following a team of scientists who are conducting research on the Antarctic seabirds, and, you know, like terns, skuas, petrels, albatross, all these sort of things, and how they are indicators of the whole food chain around South Georgia Island in the Antarctic seas, from the whole trophic system, from like phyto and zooplankton and krill, all the way up to the birds, the penguins, the cetaceans and seals and things, and everything in between. So that's kind of an exciting project because I've pitched it to the scientists as, I don't know how it's going to look like this, but my pitch has been that it's going to be like a documentary version of a Star Trek episode. Like, you have this ragtag team of people from all different walks of life, different genders, different backgrounds, different languages, different ages. But they're all here on a scientific journey together, or a new frontier that is rarely explored by, you know, the human race, and conducting exciting scientific research. And I think that has artistic merit. I mean, I think it has aesthetic value, what they're doing. I think that it sounds so, I don't know, quaint or esoteric, but like, I think them studying these seabirds around the Antarctic has as much aesthetic value as composing a symphony or painting a mural or making a film. So I'm very excited to be involved in that. And it'll be, the main character of it is a friend of mine from college. Her name is Samantha Monnier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a young woman in STEM in her 30s, getting her PhD in biology, evolutionary biology, and studying these birds in one of the last frontiers on our planet. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of cool. So that starts filming this July.
Oh, okay. Did she approach you about this, or did you already have it in
mind? Yeah, we were kind of casual, friendly acquaintances in college. We became better friends when we found out we were living in the same city and stayed in touch. We'd, you know, go to museums or zoos or go out to dinner now and then. And she would say, kind of with the same sort of trepidatious, cautious, like, you know, attitude that I had when I was seeking leads for Persistence of Vision, she kind of was saying, would you ever, with the idea of ever maybe possibly directing a documentary about, you know, team of biologists going around Antarctica, would that ever interest you? Hmm. I was like, yeah, of course it would. And I was like, yeah, because we need to hire someone to do that at some point. Maybe if we get the grant money.
And lots of maybes.
Apparently, a lot of maybes. Because honestly, these things rarely ever get funded. Same with movies.
Yeah.
But, and this isn't to stroke my ego, because honestly, maybe if they had gotten someone else, they also would have gotten the gig. But what the National Science Foundation told Sam and the team was that, you know, outreach is really important when you're doing scientific research. Like, how will you get the general public to care about this? How will you get your story known? How will you tell the story? And her idea was, let's make a documentary. Let's hire someone. And my previous works, she knew and liked, and we got along. And getting along with people is a very important part of soft life skills in making movies. And she reached out to me first, and the price was agreeable, and the schedule was agreeable, which basically any price at any point in my schedule was agreeable. But yes, it was agreeable, because I would make the time to do this project for sure. Mm-hmm. Almost inarguably. And then she said, all right, well, we got the gig because we hired you. Like, they National Science Foundation was like, documentary sounds like a great idea, he seems like the guy to do it.
Cool.
Here's some money. So now we're doing this. It's gonna be, and it will probably be the most arduous thing I do in my life so far. Mm-hmm. But hopefully one of the most rewarding too. So we'll see how it turns out. I'll come back with something.
Are you going to sleep in a tent on the ice?
Like, no, we're going to be on a ship the whole time. On the
okay, because some people do that. They go down
Antarctic
to sleep on the on the continent. And I'm like, I don't know if I'd want to
yeah,
do that.
we're for budgetary and to a lesser but also important extent for COVID reasons, we'll probably not set foot on the continent itself.
Oh, okay.
But a lot of the Antarctic ecosystem is actually marine anyway. So okay. We're really going around the sub-Antarctic to South Georgia Island, but geographically and biogeographically, it is Antarctica. It's just not the continent. It's sort of like if you were to go to Cuba and you've technically been North America. You know, it is North America biogeographically and geographically, or been to Sri Lanka, you've technically been to Asia. So we'll be going around South Georgia Island and around the rim of the continent and starting from the southernmost part of Chile in Patagonia, around Tierra del Fuego and through the fjords down there. So, and during winter, which is actually the most the least expensive time of year to go down there, because it is the most dangerous and least comfortable time of year to go down there, the austral winter. So I will definitely discover if I get seasick or not down there. The waters, they are the roughest waters on the planet, the Drake Passage during winter time. So, and that'll be our first 3 days.
Yeah, so that's it. That's but you're doing this in July, you said? So it's summer here, but winter there.
It's their winter. That's their January.
Okay.
That's their January.
So it's like Australia. Yeah. Okay, got it. But further south. Okay. Then the other film, I think, is The Duck of New York. Is that what it's called?
Oh.
Or is that
I forgot
one?
About that. It's a little of both. So, okay, this is actually an interesting segue, because I in 2018, you know, Persistent Division was kind of, both Persistent Division and Tangent Realms, I kind of wiped my hands of, but I had heard of this duck showed up in late 2018, this rare, not rare, but a Mandarin duck, which is pretty much non-existent in the Western Hemisphere. It lives in East Asia. What was a Mandarin duck doing in Central Park? And it had a band on its leg, which meant it came from somewhere in captivity. But nobody claimed to have owned this duck. And he just sort of appeared in Central Park, and a whole global media frenzy, like, blossomed around him. And I went with one of my former students and now friends, Marcus Cochran, who's helped me out on Inongo and been involved in other projects too. You know, he's just this kid from Brooklyn and really a attentive eye and ear for filmmaking. He has tremendously good taste and really great guy to work with. And so I said to Marcus, hey, do you want to film this? Maybe we can get something. And so we filmed it. And then the duck was just kind of there for a while. And we had plenty of footage. So it's like, okay, I guess we'll see what happens next. And then the duck disappeared in March of 2019. So we're like, okay. Is he going to come back? We don't know. So we waited a few months to see if he would come back. And so we could have an ending to the movie. And then I got laid off from my day job. And then I didn't have any money. And then a pandemic hit. And then nobody was filming anything. And the film festival shut down. And for like 3 or 4 years, I was, three years, I was sitting on this footage that I had actually almost entirely edited of this duck. And then the world started to kind of reemerge out of the haze of the pandemic. And I kind of started to get more financial stability with freelancing and other gigs and teaching. And I was like, I have a 98% finished movie, 10-minute movie, about this quirky little duck that showed up in Central Park and then disappeared as smoothly as he appeared, and the frenzy that surrounded that in the public. And I was like, why not just put it out there? So I don't know when and where it's going to show exactly, but eventually in the next few months or so, or within a year or so, there will be a short documentary with my name on it and with Marcus involved too. We just shot it for fun. It's nothing like big and serious, but you know, like what you were saying earlier, like sometimes you just look at streaming sites and you find these like rare hidden gems of films. Like sometimes they're short or mid-length, these documentaries. And even some of my favorite filmmakers, like, you know, Werner Herzog or David Attenborough, like not everything they have to make has to be a giant feature length epic. Sometimes it's just a little story. Like even writers will do that. They'll have a novel, but they'll also have little novellas or like a short stories. Mm-hmm. So I was like, as a filmmaker, you can do that too. You don't always have to make a giant feature length epic that takes 5 or 6 or 7 years or whatever. You can sometimes just once in a while have little short stories. Some things are better as little anecdotes or little musings or observations. And the duck doesn't need to have a 2-hour epic. He can just be a 10-minute little story. And that's what it is. It's just a little interesting thing that happened in New York. And it kind of empowered me to make more of these things. So I'm kind of eyeing a few more things and talking to some people actually in the animation world, because I think there's a lot of good stories in film history and animation history that haven't been really dug up. So I've been talking to some folks, like, you know, colleagues of ours, like Tommy Stathis or John Canemaker, and you know, just like looking for ideas that are out there in film history. And maybe I'll just, like, between the big things like Inongo or the Antarctic thing, like maybe once in a while there'll be like a short that comes out, or it's like related to the feature or not related to the feature at all. Just because I just think it's really important to just like keep making work. Yeah. And, you know, Persistence of Vision and Tangent Realms were released 6 years apart. That's plenty of time for someone to forget who you, for like an industry or the film festival world to forget who you are.
Yeah.
And like have to be reminded, or, you know, a fan base or supporters to forget who you are. And you, if you lose that stamina, you lose that credibility. And more important than street cred is artistic stamina, I think. And I think it's just good to keep making work. It doesn't always have to be this monolithic, sprawling epic. It can sometimes just be a little short story. So I'm actually now, I wouldn't say overloading myself because I know my limit, but I am playing with just making more stuff just for the fun of it and getting back to, like, because the more you make stuff, the better you get at making it. So the more films one makes, the better of a filmmaker you become. And I've learned that being a teacher. The more I teach, the better of a filmmaker I've become. The more I make movies, the better I get at teaching filmmaking. And seeing my students make small works in their early development has, I think, inspired me to, like, go back to my roots and, like, make little things and go back to, like, the avant-garde experimental filmmakers tradition of just, like, just keep churning stuff out. Just, like, keep getting better. And, we'll see where it goes.
Okay. Now, I think I mentioned this before we started, so, and you may not have anything to say other than, yes, I was a talking head, you know. you were interviewed for the film Cartoon Carnival, which has come out.
That's right.
So were a lot of other people that you just mentioned, John Canemaker and a few others. What was the circumstances where they consulted you? I mean, are you a huge fan of, like, early animation or just all animation, or what's your
I am a huge fan of
knowledge base.
Well, I guess that I don't know how to measure that. I'm not as much of a scholar as the people who get more time in the film than I do. I mean, I'm in the documentary briefly as what's described by my lower third as a cartoon carny, which I guess was the director Andrew T. Smith's description for people who would frequent Tommy Stathis's fantastic 16 millimeter monthly screenings of rare early animation films. I love those screenings, and Tommy and I are good friends. I frequently speak in his classes at universities and colleges here in New York, like at SBA and other locations. And we get along really well. And I've gotten through him, and through, actually even more so through Persistence of Vision, I've gotten to know people like John Canemaker and Jerry Beck and J.J. Settlemayer, and, you know, I'm friendly with them and friends with them. And so I'm briefly a talking head in Cartoon Carnival, which is great because, well, also because I was considering I didn't really put any work into it, but just like a daydream I had. I was considering maybe making a short film or documentary about Tommy Stathis and his work, actually, coincidentally. And then Andrew Smith was already making this thing. And I was like, well, that actually kind of works out because I'm busy with the Tangent Realms thing. So you know, no hard feelings at all. But then he hired me to do some, because he lives in the UK. He needed someone to film the some sequences in New York when he couldn't make it here. So I actually filmed the interviews filmed the interviews with J.J. Settlemayer, John Canemaker, and Jerry Beck, because they were in town, yeah. and Andrew was not. So I kind of got to make the documentary about early animation without having to make the documentary about early animation. That may change someday. I might make something about that stuff because I do love it. Yeah. I mean, what I really love about early animation, you know, even back to like the late 19th century, is that this is such an emerging art form that it is inherently experimental.
Yeah.
There's just such play and creativity going on in the process because the rules aren't set and the industry isn't completely developed yet. It isn't yet a mechanized craft. It is still a magic trick. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing them figuring out things between ones and twos and how much is too much and how much is too little and the fluidity of things. And I love seeing fully animated moving backgrounds. And I love when they would incorporate 3D back, like the Fleischers would incorporate 3D backgrounds with 2D characters in the foreground in the 30s. I love seeing the pre-code stuff with like Betty Boop and things a little bit more risque and like, you know, even by today's standards, it kind of stand out as like, wow, I wasn't expecting that from an American cartoon. I love seeing like the French magic tricks, like by, you know, and artists by Emile Cole and, you know, I mean, Winsor McKay's stuff is just so spellbinding today. The fluidity of it, the way that things rotate without any computer assistance at all, just right. Like, just knowing how that's supposed to work in your mind's eye and executing that drawing by drawing is just mind-blowing. So that might be my favorite era of animation because it is just so pure. It's not even really defined for any particular audience or demographic or industry or product yet. It's just very entertaining art that is figuring out what it is. You know, I love seeing that process. So perhaps one day I'll make something related to that stuff. But it was cool to and surreal to to be involved in that because, you know, I'm in touch with Andrew. We get along really well. And I'm in touch with Tommy. We get along really well. And they reminded me years later that Cartoon Carnival was going to show on Turner Classic Movies. So we like got the app to watch it on our TV here, and my wife and I, and it was so surreal because I knew that I had done some behind the scenes work on it, but I completely forgot that I was interviewed for it because I was interviewed like 5 years prior. Right, I totally forgot that I was interviewed.
Yeah,
and you know, there's these disembodied voices in the very beginning of the film. And I'm like the third one, and I hate hearing my own voice, which is why I'll never listen to this. I apologize. Mark, I might not ever listen to this thing, but I hate hearing my own voice. But it was like, I was like stunned to hear my voice. So was Danielle, my wife. And then I think it was just after or just before someone used the phrase persistence of vision.
Uh-huh.
Not in reference to my documentary, in reference to the old theory of how animation was understood by the human brain or the human eye, but just that juxtaposition, just I totally forgot that I was in the movie. And then like Danielle's best friend like texted her and said, Kevin's in this documentary that I'm watching on TV. She didn't even know about the connection because she just happened to have Turner Classic Movies on. And she, yeah, it was very, very surreal. But it was really cool to be part of that project because, again, that was a documentary that, you know, has a very, like, good historical perspective. But, you know, it was artfully made, too. I like that Andrew, you know, had this sort of color scheme in mind to give it, like, the faded print quality. And I liked the way he incorporated the footage and the way he went back and forth between the present and the past, kept it moving along nicely. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's a really nice piece, that film. It's an honor to be attached to that thing in a small way.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you know Tommy so well, try to get him for this show.
No, I should, yeah.
Yeah, he is someone that I've been trying to get for a while, but not seriously. I mean, not as seriously as I should. That's what I did get JJ Settlemeyer to agree, and
great.
I'm probably going to record with him next month, so because he's a little bit
JJ is awesome.
Yeah,
I talk a lot.
I've met him before, but I met him at a show, and you know, it wasn't, you know.
He is a fantastic storyteller, yep. Such a good orator, yep. And a real champion of people who, I don't know, do good work. You know, like, I mean, the work you're doing, for example, and he really was proselytizing my career with Persistence of Vision, which I'm very thankful for. Him and Jerry Beck and a lot of people were been very supportive, and it's nice seeing people from different walks of life and generations like have those common interests and see value in telling these stories, which are ephemeral. If, like, you know, these stories can be lost if we don't record them, but also they're timeless stories, like the stories of these artists and these creators and these people who made the things that we see and experience, they matter. So I like that other people get that too. And it's really good to find those allies and to champion and support one another. So it's very meaningful to be in touch with folks like that.
Yeah. And I've had Jerry Beck on here, and it's like some people, not Jerry saying this, but other people go, why would you want me on the show? I don't do anything, you know, but it's like, to me, it's like the purpose of this podcast, it's my passions. You know, I like animation, TV, movies, music, and, you know, just anything that's kind of pop culture. But, you know, to me, it's like, you don't have to be famous to be a fan of something. If you're a big passionate fan about something, you know, and you can talk, you know, which you have, then, you know, I want to hear about it. So, you know, it's like, and so it makes a fascinating story, you know, so in a way it's my documentary. Anyways,
it is, it's a form of documentary. Absolutely.
I mean, I would love to make documentaries. You know, when I think about my books, it's like any one of my books could have been a documentary. It's just that, you know, I've done filmmaking before when I was in college, but I didn't keep it up because I said, wow, that takes a lot of time and effort and energy. So kudos to you.
Yeah. It's I always warn my students this, like, I don't try to ever tell them like, oh, you're not cut for filmmaking. Because if you already are that invested, you are cut for filmmaking because it takes a certain strain of person to be that committed to this. But I do warn them, like, you all are embarking on what is essentially the most expensive hobby on the planet. You know, like, some people get their creative, like, juices flowing and their, like, creativity satisfied just from, like, drawing or writing a story or, you know, playing something on the keyboard, and that stuff takes work too. But making a movie is the German term, which is a Gesamtkunstwerk, which is it's a total artwork that combines other forms of art. There is photography, there is art design, there is music, there is sound design. Depending on what kind of film, there's acting involved or screenwriting, like dialogue, you know, there is lighting, there is animation sometimes. It's all this stuff and more put together to make one big piece. And it's very challenging and expensive and time consuming. But when it works, there's nothing else like it, because it's almost like you've unlocked this sort of weird key to immortality. Like, as long as the technology and the civilization provides it, you know, these films could outlive us. And I don't know, that's kind of neat to think about. They're making this little time capsule that maybe in the future, as long as we haven't obliterated ourselves, or it hasn't become lost media. I know. Gloom and doom, end of the world film. That would actually make a really good documentary. People's opinions on the end of the world. I've considered that in the past, actually, but I you know, it's nice to think that there's sort of a little something of you going out there beyond you. You know, I don't know. It's kind of special.
Cool.
And movies are a great way of doing that.
I guess you have a lot on your plate, but is there anything like immediately that you're thinking, well, once these are done, you know, or you probably have a zillion ideas rolling around your head or something, and say, you know, and then
I try not. Now, you know? I try not to announce anything until it's actually happening.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
So, yes.
Yeah.
But
you want to get these out of the way, the Inongo, the
Antarctica. Yeah. Don't count your chickens before they hatch. Kind of thing.
I get it. Yeah.
But you're right. I have plenty on my plate. If I had no ideas.
Yeah.
I would also be very set. That's plenty. I'm going, you know, a sprawling documentary that's part animation plus a film being shot in Antarctica. Like, that's plenty for now, too. But yeah, some other things will trickle out.
Okay. I have an idea for you, but I'll say it after we're off the air. So,
okay.
Because I'm just curious if you're taking it, but I don't want to say
yeah,
it.
Yeah, sure. No.
Anyway, but. I guess that's pretty much wraps everything up because, you know, I asked about most of your films and everything like that. And, you know, you're currently an instructor. Where are you teaching? I'm just curious. I just wanted to ask.
Oh, yeah. Well, I occasionally do like teaching gigs at places like School of Visual Arts or I've been lucky to be invited at major film schools in Denmark and Australia here and there. But really, most of my teaching is at this really wonderful nonprofit called RealWorks, RealWorks Teen Filmmaking. They're here in Brooklyn, New York, where I'm at. And their whole attitude is change the storytellers, you change the world. So their philosophy is, you know, and their practice for over 20 years has been to, you know, empower young prospective filmmakers who are, you know, usually in their teens, usually from low income backgrounds, usually, you know, people of color or women or, you know, different genders and different walks of life, young people who may not have a great shot at getting into a very competitive media landscape, but have the tenacity and enthusiasm and skill sets to do it. So we help them learn those skill sets and hone those that craft. And so I've been teaching documentary filmmaking, stop motion animation, film history, experimental filmmaking, and some other things with this great after school program here and there for the past 5 years, and love doing it. I love mentoring there. I learn a lot from the students. I know that sounds cheesy, but I really, really do. You become a better filmmaker when you teach filmmaking, and it's a reciprocal thing. I learn a lot from the students, honestly, and I've even built friendships with them and with my coworkers. And in this coming fall, I'll be teaching at Robert Morris University for a whole semester in college level education on documentary filmmaking. And I hope to make that part of my career in general, you know, balancing teaching with filmmaking, because again, they're very reciprocal, and it's good to have, you know, a day job that I really love to do and that is reliable, and learning from the next generation of storytellers, and then having hopefully some free time for my own little passion projects too here and there.
And you can always find some potential production assistants, I suppose,
with your honestly students. that's also what they do. They you know, I have collaborated with some of my students, like, and they are real, like, professionals now. Like, they are making things happen in the industry, and I think changing the world, because it really is important to have a multiplicity, all different experiences of the human experience in media and storytelling, because, you know, filmmaking is universal. Cinema is universal. So if you really want to make a universal work of art, you need to have all different walks of life represented and shared and expressed. So I love that that's the attitude at RealWorks, and that's something that I try to foster in my own work and with my collaborators. And yeah, it's great to do that. So I really hope that I can keep balancing the filmmaking and teaching worlds together, you know.
Okay. Well, that kind of wraps it up. Is there any way how do people get in contact with you if they want to talk to you? Or, make personal appearances right now? I mean, you might be too busy making films. So it might be not right at the moment.
I'm always down to at least talk about something like that. Like, I'll do screenings or, you know, lectures or classes or something like that, you know, at schools, universities, colleges, museums, whatever, film festivals, repertory cinemas. I love doing stuff like that. If people want to reach out to me about that or anything else related to that, like kevinschreck.com, hopefully the spelling will be
it's not like the
understood. No, unfortunately, you know, I wish I got residuals from that, but they changed the spelling on purpose, I'm sure. S-C-H-R-E-C-K. Yes. So yeah, they can reach out to me through the contact, through my website. Some of the movies are on Vimeo and on home format, and to be continued, right?
Sounds good. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Kevin, for being a guest today and telling me about your career so far. And hopefully you'll have a lot of other the dog's barking. Hopefully a lot more documentaries coming up that we'll all be interested in and looking forward to Inongo and Antarctica, at least. So, and the duck.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. In the meantime.
And that kind of wraps it up here for another Fun Ideas podcast, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, Kevin Schreck, for being my special guest. Remember, you can always watch the video version of this episode on YouTube. Episode number 210 will be coming soon. If you would like to comment and or be a guest on this podcast, please drop me a line at funideas.mark@gmail.com. Become a patron of Mark Arnold and Fun Ideas Productions. If everyone listening just contributed a dollar a month, that would be a tremendous help in continuing the production of my books and this podcast. Also, subscribe to my YouTube channel. The opening and closing music for the Fun Ideas podcast is provided courtesy of Andrew the Slow Poisoner Goldfarb and is used with permission. This has been the Fun Ideas podcast. This is Mark Arnold speaking. This episode is copyright 2022, Fun Ideas Productions. Thank you and good night.